All right, guys, welcome to another episode of Texas Man Cave. I'm Aaron, Jeremy, and Hayden. We are excited today to have Charles Perry with us, one of our local representatives here for the great state of Texas. And, man, we're just going to dive into a couple things and just talk like we normally do with some stuff. We usually start off an episode talking about Formula One. Do you watch Formula One at all?
I don't watch Formula One much. Okay. Texas has a vibrant Formula One industry. I was there when it came into fruition. Susan Combs, awesome. Former Texas State comptroller, went to Europe, just got the bug for it, brought it back to Texas, said we need to do this. It was hotly debated for, I think, a couple of sessions.
Yeah.
And brought it in, but I think I'm supposed to ride in go-karts on the track here summer, maybe.
So that is really awesome.
It may be fun, but I have not actually been and saw the race. I've had opportunity, but I probably voted against it for different reasons.
Sure.
So I felt kind of like not being a hypocrite, but yeah. At the time they were asking for a significant investment from the state.
Sure.
And that's one of those slippery slopes, and we do it all the time. And state of Texas is typically the beneficiary of those policy decisions. But looking at it from a limited government and what is the role of private sector and where do those meet is always a conversation. Ultimately, ended up in a pretty good place. I think it was built around kind of the proceeds of sales tax and economic development in that area for those weekends.
Yeah.
And effectively, the state really wasn't out any money. They were actually, I think, basically guaranteeing a certain amount so that the promoters could come in with some confidence that if it's just a flop, that maybe they wouldn't have to eat the whole elephant at that one bite. So it was a balance. There was a happy balance. But I'm looking forward to going to see it and hear it. I think that's probably what you did.
Yes.
You hear it a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, it did. It put Texas on a map again for different reasons. We're the leader in so many different things. It was right that we had one of those.
Yeah.
I just hate the fact that it was in Austin.
Right,
We have cheaper and more space out here.
It was
a conversation, I guarantee you, but not any support to get it out here.
That would have been incredible if it ended up here.
There's a few guys around town that have been talking about trying to put something together. Long term, you know, with just obviously we've got a ton of space and tons of land to be able to do something like that.
Right.
So that'd be awesome. Well, we'll just dive into that real quick. We won't really talk about the last race in China. Got Miami coming up this week. But the big news, a couple things. Fernando Alonso signs with Aston Martin to give him a long term deal.
Yep.
I know a lot of the other teams were trying to get him to come on board. And then Adrian Newey.
Alonso, though, that's what I wanted to really press on. He signed a forever deal, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
He signed a, as long as I want to race, I'm going to get paid deal.
I think it's more of a, as long as I want to be a part of the team kind of thing. So an ambassador deal, because that's kind of somebody else we're going to talk about is kind of working on as well. But because that's like Schumacher had with Ferrari for a while, but then he ended up coming back and going for and racing, you know, a couple seasons for Mercedes at the end of his career. But,
you know, the Supreme Court has similar arrangement, and that doesn't work out too good after about 85.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So I'm not sure that's smart business planning at all.
I agree.
So I just say.
Yep.
At 62, I realize there are things I probably don't need to be doing 10 years from now.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's what? What we look at? He's 44 or something?
Yeah. 43, no, 44? No, 42.
Something like
42.
That.
He's the same age as I am.
Yeah, and these kids that are coming in their 20s or even younger to race, and he's out there still, you know, dominating somewhat, you know. So another 10 years, I don't know that he should be out there for sure.
Top five still, I mean, though, it's...
Yeah.
He's definitely...
Having come through the 50s, you're really pretty at your peak. You're really in your game around 50, 55-ish, but from there, it kind of things, reflexes and other things. But, you know, you're smart enough to know what you should do and shouldn't do.
Yeah,
and you're physically able to do most of it. So there's some merit to that 45 to 55 range.
That's where he does a lot of his racing, and a lot of his success comes from the fact that he has been doing it so long that he outsmarts these kids, and it's like only a guy with that kind of experience would even try what he just did, and it worked.
Yep.
You know, so. Yep. Yeah, he benefits from it a lot.
Yep. Well, Adrian Newey, I kind of mentioned that, leaving Red Bull.
Yes.
That's insane. They're letting him go. So he's like just this world-renowned car designer. they give a ton of their success over the last couple of years, basically based on him from his, you know, designs and wind tunnel testing and all that stuff. But who's going to snag him?
I thought Mercedes already did.
Mm-mm. Nobody signed him down yet.
I didn't know that he hadn't been signed. I thought he was going to Mercedes, but I would think, I know Aston Martin was going for him for a long time.
Everybody was.
They were.
I bet he goes to Ferrari. As an automotive designer, why would you not want to end your career at like the pinnacle?
It depends on if they allow him to do the same thing as Red Bull and make his own car. They literally allowed him to design, manufacture, and everything with their equipment, his own automobile company, basically.
Well, the rumor is that they're coming hot and heavy for him. So
I would say it's got to be a car manufacturer, whether it be Mercedes, Ferrari, Aston Martin, one of those three are going to, because they're going to benefit from him building a supercar as well.
Right. Yep. Well, then the last little thing we'll touch on there, Max, big rumors that he's meeting with Mercedes after the Miami Grand Prix this week.
He's going to go where new he goes.
You think so?
I know he will.
Yes. There's not a seat at Ferrari.
They'll make one. I'll bet you they make one for Max if they give Newey the job.
There's no way they have the money to be able to do that, to bring in Hamilton, have Charles, and then who's going to go?
We've got a man of politics right there. I guarantee that
they'll figure out a way to do it.
They'll figure out a way to do it.
Yeah.
There's one thing that's consistent in the Texas Senate. The rules are there, but you can always suspend them.
Exactly. Exactly. It's,
oh man,
they will pay out contracts, whatever they have to do, because everybody knows that Newey's the key to a car that can win the championship. Max is the driver to do it.
But could Hamilton, could Charles, could any of the other top-tier drivers, Alonso, could they be as successful as Max is in a Newey car?
Do you want to take the chance? As a company.
Yep.
You're not going to, you know? Yep. It's that simple.
Well, Miami this weekend, it's another sprint race, so that's going to be a fun weekend. It won't be at 2 o'clock in the morning either, so that'll be nice. So we actually, I think 11 o'clock is a sprint race on Saturday, so right after Coffee and Cars, we'll be starting to watch that. But
yeah.
Cool. Well, anything else, F1?
I haven't watched the news, so no.
Well, I just wanted to kind of get through it, so we've got an awesome guest here, and so I kind of wanted to dive into it. Mr. Perry, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you're from Texas. You've got some grown kids.
Grew up in Sweetwater.
Okay.
Came to Tech in 80, been here ever since. Married to the same woman for 43 years almost, 42 to 3. Two kids. And the best thing in life, the best title I've got that actually cost me money is Pops.
My grandkid calls me Pops.
Yeah, four littles awesome. and a 18-year-old. Life is fun. Life is good. We see them every day. They live here in Lubbock. We're fortunate to be that. CPA by trade, recently sold to Practice. I've been in politics since 11, two sessions in the House, and then the remaining basically 14 years, about 10 of them in the Senate.
So
Started the Senate in 2015. So.
Okay.
I saw your birthday is March 9th.
It is.
That is actually my anniversary.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you know, interesting enough, Curtis Parrish, the county commissioner judge here, is March 9th. And Jody Arrington, the federal representative, is March 9th. Really? So something to do with March 9th.
It's a good day.
I haven't backdated to see what was going on those days, but that is a strange coincidence, to say the least.
Yes, it is. What's, you guys ever celebrate together?
You know, we always text.
Yeah.
We get that group text, happy birthday, brother. So
that's great.
It's good. It is. It's kind of fun.
That's awesome. What inspired you to kind of get into politics? And
never saw it coming. Yeah. I tell people I won one election prior to the House, and that was prom king in Sweetwater High. So, and you really didn't have to run for that.
Yeah.
I think it was the girl I was with. I think they were voting for her. But I didn't see it coming. But 2011 was a pivotal point, I think, in a lot of ways in the country, some good, some bad. But clearly the direction that we were going, and it wasn't just that administration. There had been previous administrations that had kind of, you know, on both sides of the political aisle that had done things that were probably not consistent with who we were as a country. And I had a practice, a CPA practice, vibrant practice, several, about a 1,200 client practice. But I found myself every day having conversations about politics. And you would look up, and for, you know, an industry that you build time to make a living, it was not very conducive to that. But more importantly, I'm kind of a put up or shut up kind of person. I don't want to waste time. I want to be productive at what I'm doing. And after a year or so of that, I was just kind of like, you know what, I'm going to either shut up, quit rapping, or I'm going to go do something about it. And at the time, an individual named Brad Bentley, he used to be the 50-yard line manager, had the same, I guess, conversation with God, because I kind of look at everything bathed in prayer before I jump out there. And we started up a group called Americans for Integrity in Government, and we were hosting it out at the 50-yard line on Monday nights. First time was 25, 50 people. And then the next week it was 100, and we got to consistently every week having several hundred people show up, and there was energy about that, and country was kind of, people were beginning to kind of take notice that you can't just elect people blindly and walk away and assume they're going to do all the good things that you need to do. And there were some fundamental, foundational changes being talked about in conversations. So anyway, there was an incumbent, Delwin Jones, at the House of Representatives here in Lubbock for, I think he had been on a ballot of something since 62.
Oh, wow.
He was one of the longest serving incumbents at the House, stalwart as far as just entrenched, not very effective, not really engaged, if you will. But to his credit, he found a way to win every time, and mm-hmm. had kind of got a pass, I think. People from this region historically elect decent people, good people, to go down and do the job. And they don't get really involved. And that was pre-social media.
Yeah.
One of the biggest changes since I've been elected and as I got into the Senate, my predecessor, Senator Duncan, had said, you know, I don't recognize the politics, and I definitely don't have the process down. This social media deal has become really, you know, a different tool, if you will, in the politics spectrum, political spectrum. So anyway, I stepped out. There was another individual in that race. It was a three-man race. You know, you have to have a circle of influence, and I kind of came out of the blue. Nobody really saw me coming, if you will. So in Israel for a church trip with a bunch of people, and they prayed me up into this running this month. Signed up. It was December was the last filing. I was in about 5 days of the last filing date, paid my fee. Mm-hmm. I never had any doubt that good Lord wasn't going to put me here to win it. I was just that wow. confident. It was a strange deal, but
really?
A three race, put up some money of my own accord and said, that's all I got to lose. That's all my wife's willing to let me lose. But I think this is what we're supposed to do. And through the runoff, I was able to garner the House seat.
Wow.
So the rest is history. But it wasn't this push to be political. It wasn't this push to be I'm active in the community, Boys and Girls Clubs, community partners, mm-hmm. Women's Protective Shelter. I mean, I had that resume, if you will, of being engaged, because I think that's what we're called to do. But I never saw me being in a state Senate seat for sure. That's kind of going from T-ball to the right. majors
yeah.
in short time. But it's been fun. It's good. It's a fun fight most of the time, fair fight sometime, and it's important work. But it has its ups and downs. But never, if you'd have told me Sweetwater, Texas, that I was going to be Texas Senator from Lubbock, I would have looked at you like you were nuts.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Can you discuss some of the major initiatives or bills you've championed during your time in office?
Yeah, so I have the whole spectrum. I have the social issues. I'm a Christian by faith, and I think that you do not separate your faith from policy.
Mm-hmm.
Your walk and your talk need to match up, and in today's world, we have lots of opportunities to engage with the faith perspective, a biblical worldview, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you'll look back at my history. And so on the social side, pro-life mm-hmm. was one of the leaders, I guess, on the Sanctuary City for the Unborns in Lubbock. So I never shy away from protecting life. That's my non-negotiable. And I think that's what I'll answer to.
Sometime
I think that we're all going to answer that call, and I want to be the guy that said I did everything within my power. So the transgender conversation has been pretty vibrant and pretty active for the last several sessions. I passed out the UIL bill for Boys Can't Play Against Girls. I've had the So I've carried a lot of that legislation. I may not have been the final author of the pass because it takes two or three sessions.
Yeah.
But it's usually built on those pre-sessions. But some of those are my bills that are passed. Sanctuary cities regarding border, 2015. I've passed that legislation that basically we can remove a local official that if they're harboring immigrants, undocumented. So I've been involved in those conversations for sure. On the meats and potatoes, the infrastructure and things, I've served as chairman of water since 2015,
mm-hmm.
Freshman chair. That was the first time a freshman chair in the Senate had existed since 93 on a standing or a substitute committee. So wow. I have spent the better part of my Senate career on multiple levels of different things, but water is my passion and water is what I do. I travel the country, the world, in conversations around the state about water supply for Texas. We're not having that conversation at the right level with the sense of urgency that it demands, but there are viable solutions. So next session, setting up a pretty detailed, granular plan for water supply for all Texans. Back up to the border bill, SB4, last session, fourth special session, SB4, was the bill that I passed that literally would allow state to arrest those that come between legal ports of entry. It was challenged, as expected. It spent some time back and forth in the Supreme Court, and Fifth Circuit, and district courts. It was immediately held unconstitutional at the district court. Surprise out of Travis County. Shocker. You know, I know that's just hard to believe. But so it moved to basically the Fifth, and the Fifth asked for expedited hearing in Supreme Court. Supreme Court originally came out and said, nope, can't do it. And then they reversed their decision and said, Texas can do it. So as highest court land said, good to go, start doing this.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, and I'm not in the judiciary, but the Fifth Circuit got it back effectively because there was a court trial pending, and they reheard it, and now it's on hold, sitting at the Fifth to decide disposition. The substance of the bill was not captured in the narrative in the media. I know that's hard to believe, too.
Yeah.
They focused on the Arizona bill that was held unconstitutional years prior because it was 100% immigration enforcement. What I did, and that is solely under the Supremacy Clause, the federal government's responsibility. What SB4, the heart of it was and is today, and I think is why I've got the courts twisted up on what to do, I didn't challenge the Supremacy Clause. I said it is absolutely 100% unequivocally undeniable federal court's role to enforce immigration.
Mm-hmm.
That said, with supremacy comes an obligation and a responsibility to act. And under the same constitution that grants them supremacy over that issue, it also gives the states the right to defend themselves. So in that same constitution, okay, there was a provision that says, if you're under imminent threat to no avail, meaning it's happening, it's going to happen, it's predictable, and I can tell you, 400 million doses of fentanyl, drug cartel, human trafficking, terror watch list, these are not possibles, these are absolutely everydays.
Yeah,
and so we are under threat. And yes, so we argued under SB4, as I intended it to be, we didn't challenge the Supreme Court, the Supremacy Act of the federal government to do this. We said, when you don't do it, very same Constitution gives us the right to do it. And so I think it's probably the first time in the history of the country that a federalism/states' rights conversation has really been made, and it's not quite as clear as what they would like it to be. That's just the Arizona law all over.
Yeah,
we stayed out of that. So it could be any issue. It doesn't have to be immigration, right? If the state's under threat, under our Constitution, we can defend ourselves.
Yes.
And Texas has spent, since 2011 when I first got elected, $12 billion, with a B, dollars of Texas taxpayers' money direct defense of the border.
Wow.
That does not include Medicaid when they show up in our ERs. That does not include incarceration cost when they enter our criminal justice system. And the biggie that it does not include, and I'm trying to figure out how to get my arms around the head around the number, it does not include our public schools cost, which is about $20,000 average between local and state contribution to a public school student. So we don't have record in that way, of, or we're not tracking it that way because the feds do not allow you to ask. So we are going to backdoor it. So anyway, I would venture very safely serving on, I serve on multiple committees. I'm vice chair of Health and Human Services. So I work in the area of Medicaid and contracts and attendant care and some of the things that everybody will need at some point in their life as far as taking care of caregivers, but CPS, foster care, that's in my wheelhouse. So, but on finance, you get to see all the math and the numbers and the dollars. I would venture to say with our public school cost of what's come through, we're north of $20 billion for the last 14 years.
Wow. How is it possible that you can register a student and not there not be a question of are you a citizen or not?
So on the school issue, our state constitution says we'll provide education for all, pretty much.
For all, okay.
It's not an exclusionary, if you meet this, you get to be a student. If you come into our public school and you're not a citizen, we're not going to serve you. And there's a public policy that, right, especially the border communities. There's a lot of traffic for years and years and years before the border was a problem that would come over daily and go to our public schools and then go home. And you argue, well, that's taking away the experience and it's, you know, we're basically subsidizing. The policy side, would agree or disagree with it, is don't you want your neighbors educated?
Yeah, and that's a tough question. That's what I was just running through my head, like, do we want to turn anybody away like that? Like if you're not a citizen and you're not supposed to be here or whatever the case may be, but it's part of the Bible that, you know, you don't turn away your neighbor. You help.
Yeah. That's a debate, right?
It's tough, and
I can see, and people don't realize it. We do billions of dollars of commerce on that border every day with Mexico and our southern partners, our ag industry specifically. And so it's a big enterprise. And prior to the cartel gaining control of that government down there and letting all this chaos ensue and creating the chaos that ensued, it was a really cool, and honestly, there was not a desire to move. It was just to do business.
Yeah.
And it works. And so there was an element that you're going to allow some of that, but our public education is for all. It's just like our Medicaid. If you show up into our indigent care, if you show up in the ER, you don't get to ask if you're a citizen before you get care. If you show up in the ER, they don't ask you what your sexual preference is to get care. You get care, and it's the right thing to do, right? I mean, you're not going to turn away from someone that's an emergency. You know, the truth of the matter is they show up with non-emergencies, and that's where it gets really crazy. Yeah. So, and then you can go into the criminal justice. Everyone's due to due process, whether you're a citizen or not. So those are fundamental foundational truths that separate us apart from the majority of the other countries in the world in some level. Some level have open borders, but it is a real, it's not quite as squeaky clean or cut and dry as you say.
Yeah.
You speak to the Christian aspect of it, and that's interesting. And it's kind of like our Constitution when you kind of get a conflict between areas that are very clearly written for different issues. When you start blending them, it's hard to do. We're supposed to, you know, be good neighbors, and we're supposed to help those. But here's what I think also that goes into that: the role of government is to protect innocent and punish evil. And when you have an open borders that are literally perpetuating evil through drugs.
Yes.
And through long-term investments into damaging and destroying a country and cartels and their human smuggling activities. When you get that element mixed in and the only thing you can do is sort the wheat and the chaff at the border and pick the goods and take the bads out, I think that's where your Christian philosophy has to be practical in that respect, that we cannot stick our head in the sand and ignore what's going on through the border. At the same time, unfortunately, the innocent are going to be part of that processing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's where we as the GOP on the right side, the red side of the spectrum, if you will, get a bad rap because nobody wants to take the time to hear that conversation. Or if they hear it, they ignore it. We're not anti-immigrant. We have a legal system that if you participate in it, you have all the opportunities in the world. If you go outside that, then you've either, one, got something to hide, you're not good for us long term, or you're just not privy to it. So we have a responsibility, but it's one of those hard conversations in when you get to the people side of it and the truth of the matter is that the other element and secret people don't want to talk about publicly is I think probably easily 20-30% of our workforce is immigrant.
Yeah.
They estimate the 17% that they can identify, but it's more than that. And if your service industries, your specialty trades industries, if not for that employment sector, you probably wouldn't. But here's the other thing. We can do this right, and we can do this better, and we can allow opportunity seekers to get there. We just have to have the focus to do it. We did it in the 50s and the 60s out of this area. It's called a Becerial program, and the farmers had a group of individuals that would come up. They'd pick them up at the border with a bus. They would drive them to the plains. They would do their cotton. They would do their harvesting, do whatever the work was. They would stay in a dorm kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
They would be 3 meals a day. They had running water. They were treated with humanity. And as soon as that harvest was done, they would get in the bus and they'd take them back down and they would see them next season.
Yeah.
And it was a generational thing, right? So it's not that we don't know, and with technology, it'd be easier. We could do this, but here's the sad truth. I don't know what each side of the political I would talk about if the border wasn't a problem. So
yeah. Well, and see it, and I've grown up with it myself. I was a transplant out of Michigan, and where I grew up in Michigan is all muck fields. So you know, that was a huge part of growing up is they did the migrant thing, and they did it very well there. You know, it was our town has turned and catered to that because it's a big part of our business. I mean, it was a big part of, you know, especially come harvest season when the migrant workers come to town and stuff like that. I mean, a lot of the businesses, even my dad's automotive business, has a bilingual employee just so they can help those people when their cars break down and things like that. And it's a big part of his business and things like that. But yeah, it's for a lot of years, me growing up, it was used to, I mean, I had friends that I played with and that were, it was like, okay, you know, when the harvest is over, we know that they're leaving, you know, mm-hmm. So I'm not going to see that friend until next year. And then it seemed to have changed probably in my early 20s that it, all of a sudden everybody, you know, it was like, oh, we're not going home anymore.
It's an entitled.
Became
entitled because somebody probably well-meaning informed them of all the benefits and things, and those were never meant to be extended. A Democratic colleague of mine in the Valley, good guy, we don't politically align on everything, but he did make a statement on the Senate floor that my Democratic side, especially the Valley Democrats, understand the problem. There is a problem. They'll tell you, we've got a real problem. Now, they don't agree with the solutions that we're providing. But he made a statement that history, and this is true, will bear you out. A country that loses its sovereignty over its borders fails to be a country long term. And that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're at. That's the pivotal point, I think, that we're at, because 2.8 million that we know about, we catch one out of three. We caught 58 terrorist watch list people the last count I had, and that was in February, probably more since. I remind people it only took about 19 to destroy the world in chaos in September a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take many to create havoc. And that when we say a terrorist watch list person was caught, that's the October 7th Hamas group that was cutting heads off of babies. It's that sleeper cell segments that are setting up shop inside our borders, and they will at some point be called to action. What that day looks like and where, who knows? But the naivety of those that say it's not a problem have not been in the conversations that the Texas legislature has.
Yeah,
is all this stuff going on this week with all the schools in Palestine and all that? I mean, is that kind of just fueling the fire in a sense? Like, a lot of those aren't the students that are going there, you know?
Yeah. So professional agitators have become a real thing, and I think Soros was the originator of some of that. I've heard J6ers that there was involvement of those guys, and that's sad, you know, because our public university system, especially back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and some of the civil rights movements were an active voice, but they were not radicalized. There were some. There was the Chicago guy, but most of them were just peacefully demonstrating and standing firm on what they believe was needing to be changed. So we don't have that in this realm. And our I'll just say that the generation of non-copers are also really impressionable. Mm-hmm. And it's in vogue to be against something, especially against the man. It's always been part of our culture. It's a little inherent. And it's probably good. I mean, at some level, it's probably something that we should take some pride in. But this this last round, and here's the conversation there, and it's really pretty short. Israel, by birthright, whether you like it or not, was given that property.
Yes.
That's theirs. And anything that is, you know, anybody that says to the contrary haven't had the scales fall off, or they're just choosing to ignore God. And that's the heart of our problems, right? I mean, original sin. Original sin is where it all started, and that's where we'll end. We'll be the death of our own self. I tell people all the time, if you want to know how we got here, look in the mirror.
Yeah.
If you want to know how we get out of here, look in the mirror.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we have a government that we choose who govern us, and we have not been active in that, so now we've got these problems. But on these kids that are out, it's horrible for innocent lives lost on anything. But we know who started it, we know why they started it, and we know where it's going to end. And all this rhetoric in between that we need a two-state solution, that's not God's plan.
Yeah.
That's their property, by birthright. Like it or not, that's the rule.
Yeah.
And until you can get past that or acknowledge that, we're going to have these kind of conflicts.
Yeah. How do we get past that? Like, what's got to happen where everybody finally just kind of like pulls their head out, you know, and has some...
It don't happen. You
it's
know,
just moves from one issue to the next.
Well, when the good Lord breaks the clouds,
that's
when it's done. Because these days are foretold.
Yeah.
And he equates these days to birth pains before the Great Tribulation. So we're seeing what is to come in a very small piece. At least that's what my faith teaches me. And we are told to be in the race. You know, as a politician, a Christian politician, it's easy to get cynical and just kind of sit back and say, we know how the story ends. Why bother? But that ain't our faith, right? You're supposed to engage. You're supposed to run the race. You're supposed to expand the territory of the gospel. You're supposed to be, and on a political level, we still have a country that, at least at some point, was founded on freedom of religion, on ability to speak, on the ability to you know, expand. And so I think one of the founder's writings said it best in a letter, a very lengthy and detailed as they used to write, and that old English. But it effectively, the core was, we don't need a one-state solution for religion. We don't need a one-state religion. That's not what we're about, and that's what we left. But if you Christians do your job, it takes care of itself.
Yeah.
We haven't done our job.
Mm-hmm.
Plain and simple. So to how it ends or what's going to change, I don't know how many more redemptive second chances the good Lord's got in his sleeve, but all I know is I'm supposed to get up every day and go run that race.
Yep.
Yeah.
Amen. How do you feel about the local May 4th election with Proposition A?
Proposition A is, you know, so there was about 10,000 legitimate signatures that got that on the ballot. And to their credit, they played by the rules. I got the Sanctuary City on the ballot, the same process. So good and bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just looking at the political math here. There was 10,000 people that supported that prop that got it to the ballot, assuming if all 10,000 showed up and voted. We're at 30,000 plus, I think. Biggest May election in the history of Lubbock, bar none. They said you could stop Tuesday after the last day of early voting and you would be ahead of every May election, including the last day. So
amazing.
It turned out 2-1. I mean, it's 20,000 to 10,000 in my book. So I think the prop goes down.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it would. I thought it would be close, but I think that the people that showed up got the message through churches and other places that probably half of them were oblivious to even there was an issue until their church or their pastor or somebody mentioned it. But so I like our odds on Prop A. I think it goes down. Mm-hmm. I did a ride along with the sheriff about a week ago, and I wish every citizen would. I think they could.
Yeah,
would go through a quarterly task force initiative to focus on local drug and problems. There was 50 arrests that night.
Wow.
And most of the biggest one we did was in during the day, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But if you could see the impact of drugs, and I'm talking, there's always an element of pot, usually in the arrest, or they started there from years ago, and then you moved to the opiate and the meth pills, and now fentanyl. But if people could understand, it's not about the 4 ounces of weed. It's about the whole environment in that industry. So if you're hooked, you probably not got a job. So how do you get your money to buy your weed? You create a crime. So it's that whole criminal element to it. So it's really disingenuous the way it's being pitched. And so I like props four on the mayor's race. It should be a runoff. I have my pick. I promised all sides that I would not publicly get out and chastise either one of them, but we'll see what runoff happens.
So speaking of voting and stuff, man, how do we get people out to, like, I just feel like if everybody would get out and do their part and vote, there would be an overwhelming just like domination of what this country is really supposed to be based on and what people really feel.
If you could answer that, then I think you'd be my next pick for president.
If I can figure that out, I probably would.
Here's the deal. It's so multifaceted and tenets go all directions. So first of all, as politics go, as politicians go, we have sullied that career, if you will, that position to the point that there's no trust, there's no credibility. And even the good guys go up and get caught up in it, and the good guys go up to fight it and have no results. So the average person that's busy making mortgage payments, raising kids, trying to get on with life, the last thing they want to do is invest any amount of time into figuring out who is this guy running and what does he stand for, because that takes energy.
And it takes a lot of energy to do your due diligence and really research a person, because, I mean, it's – what's on the surface isn't always what you're getting either, you know? No, so,
you know, it's human nature I'll say it this way. In the Texas legislature, for the most part, there's very few that are in it for the position or the power or the prestige that comes with it, because that's just a natural element of what you do down there. I mean, mm-hmm. you're one of 31 people that swings a needle for the country out of the Texas Senate. That's a pretty burdensome responsibility.
Oh, yeah.
I look at that when I make that vote and go, we just changed 30 million people, but maybe 330 million people's life, because the Texas Senate leads a lot of initiatives throughout. So, but most people truly have a heart to serve. Every one of them. D's and R's alike, they are there because they like to serve.
Yeah.
The conflict is your personal beliefs. If you can't protect them and hold on to them, then you become part of that process and machine that people detest.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not easy. I tell people if I leave and when I leave and I look in the mirror, and if I see 98% of myself, then I consider it success.
Yeah.
But that's a struggle every day to stay in that. So first of all, we need to clean up our house, our own house. We need to fix our stuff. And then we need to be elected based on what we have said, but more importantly what we do, and then go down there and stay true to that, and then you would see some engagement. The other side is we have done exactly what our founders said not to do, and that's vote benefits to the average citizen. So we've become so I think Franklin said it, your democracy will last as long as you don't vote from the largesse, I think was his term, the treasures of the country. We are so much about us and about my cause and my issues, and we can't undo that. That genie is out of the box, right?
Yeah.
And to my voters that support me and believe in me in limited government, the conversation that we can pull all that back, that's just not real. You can't go out and say we're going to get rid of Medicaid. It's been in existence since 50s or 60s. I'm not sure that we should. They do take care of indigent health care.
Yeah.
But the argument that the private sector would have been better is probably true, but we're a socialist system on so many levels, we just don't want to tell people that.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, that S word's really bad, and we don't want to be a socialist. But the truth of the matter is, our healthcare system is socialized. Our transportation system, our roads and bridges, has been socialized forever. We put gas taxes to it, and we built it out. Now, arguably, that was probably the best thing to do, because you got a connectivity there that you would not have had if you had relied on every individual community and state and area. So there is areas where it makes sense to do those things. But what we've done is opened up all of the social ills, all the problems of the society, of a lost world, and said, we can fix that as government. And I don't think we'll ever get it back in, because the political cost of getting that, you make that vote one time, you're gone. So then you're now no longer effective.
Yeah.
So you got to have a group, a majority, right, to show up and say, we're going to do this. We're going to find a responsible way out of some of this, and we're going to turn it back over to where people have more control of their pocketbooks. But that's not going to happen. So you take the political environment, the scumbag and the scummiest things that people see and hear are true, and you throw in the deal that everybody has been basically set apart based on what they want, and it goes back to self-idol, original sin. You know, I know better, and I'm one of 330 million little gods, and I say what's good for me, and I want my government to pay for that. And that's where we're at.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about being in government as long as you have, the difference in when you got into now in the bipartisanship?
Good question, and here's a statistic you're not going to believe. We will see 7,000-8,000 bills filed from between a January and a May every odd year. So in 25, we go back in January. There'll be 7,000 bills filed on average. I'll take close to 3,000 or 4,000 votes that 5 months through hearings and sessions and floors and debates. Of that bill, those bills, about 1,200 get to the governor's desk for signing. Wow. Of the 1,200 bills that got signed by the governor, off the Senate floor vote for that bill to get to the governor, only about 30 were partisan votes.
Wow.
That doesn't happen at the feds. We still work together really well. We have a healthy respect. People don't know it. We have a Bible study every week, House and Senate on each side. Show up if you want to. Don't. We have Sunday services if we're stuck there on the weekends. And the last few sessions, the 31 senators have held hands and did the Lord's Prayer on the way out the door.
Wow.
So we still are pretty tight.
Yeah.
It's changing. So the personalities, the philosophies are the philosophy is the same. The personalities are a little bit more bolder, a little bit more engaged, a little bit better funded since I've got in. But generally speaking, in Texas, we still pull together and get most of the things done that need to get done.
Yeah, yeah. Is there, do you go through times that you feel pressured to, you know, if you don't believe in something, or if the Republicans are going one way and the Democrats are going another way, that you feel under pressure to vote that way?
Yeah, I mean, every day.
Yeah.
You know, there's two parties for a reason. There's two, everybody's a type A personality with no plan B.
Yeah.
You just got elected to represent 30 million people. That didn't come because you were meek and mild and sat in a corner all day.
Yeah.
I'll give you a great example. My party, and rightfully concerned, put a bill up last session where it would prohibit transfer of property to Chinese folks. The theory is that all Chinese folks are tied to the CCP, and they have an agenda. And that is true at some level, but not all are. Here's the deal. I've worked for this government to know I need to worry about the government I serve more than the guys over the water. I've seen what our government can do. And so I voted against the bill. I was one of 31. I was the only GOP senator that voted against the bill. And the logic is this. So this is where I thought. First of all, the only thing that really separates us from other folks is the ability to acquire, develop, and build wealth. And you do that by private property, right? So the last thing I was going to do was give the government the right to tell me I can't transfer my wealth by sale. I can't create more wealth generationally, because now that's locked up by the government prohibition. If I use an example, if my wife had cancer, the only thing I got left is a ranch, and I got nobody to leave it to, and I got somebody wanting to write a check, and they're from China, I don't want the government doing that. But more importantly, as a practical concern, this is the same government that for 2 years told me who was essential and who was non-essential. This is the same government that shut people down and destroyed lives. It's also the same government that in Cochrane County today, because of the fear that a prairie chicken might lay an egg, that my farming community could not grow winter wheat. So really? They take your liberties by regulation. The last thing I was going to do is give them the right to take my ability to transfer wealth. Now, it is not the back of the landowners to solve this problem. It is our federal government. They have a responsibility to survey and to keep us safe, protect us from IP theft, protect us from cyber warfare, protect us. And in Texas, we do have prohibitions against people of foreign nations of certain character that can't build next to infrastructure like Air Force bases or utilities or things like that. I'm for that. That's just smart. But I was kind of viewed as that guy. But in my mind, giving up the right of acquiring, developing, and transferring wealth was something I couldn't go to for fear that I was going to be unsafe by someone that bought property next to me.
Right.
So to your question, do I ever find myself at odds with either side? One side more than not, but there are problems on my policy on my side of the aisle that are probably intended to address a problem, but they're creating an unintended consequence that's not worth the price.
Yeah, yeah. And that has been a thing lately, hasn't it?
What's
with,
that?
With basically the Chinese government ending up with property in prime locations for military.
And I think, again, in Texas, you can't build one next to a critical infrastructure like a utility. You can't build one next to a military base. That's common sense, smart things to do.
Yeah.
But the law wasn't specifically restricted to those common sense things. It was pretty broad. I told it in committee, I said, mark my words, the government that shut people down for 2 years will also come after our fossil fuel industry under this bill if they get a chance. And so China was the threat today. Fossil fuel is the threat by this administration. It wasn't 30 days that Biden came out with a dictate that you will not have any more leasing on public lands when they're over with. In other words, you're not going to get to renew your lease.
Wow.
And I said, point made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Told you
yeah.
so.
So that's kind of me. I'm that guy.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I got a couple more. How do you envision the future of Texas, and what role do you see yourself playing in shaping it? Like, how much longer do you feel like you're going to serve? And
The good Lord will hopefully let me know before the voters do. I'm very competitive, so I don't want to go out the wrong way.
Yeah.
The answer to your question, I don't want to be anywhere else but Texas. And I've traveled the world. I've been in this country, and there's good people all over this place. But Texas has the opportunity to change the world for so many levels, different issues. But if our Christian faith would get back engaged, Texas would lead in that. We still have mm-hmm. some of the fundamental groups that get what's right and what's wrong, and still believe in that doctrine, still preach it in the pulpits here in Lubbock. But from a Texas perspective, there are no limits to what we can achieve and what we will do based on our natural resources, based on the people here, and based on honestly the West Texas independent / get it done attitude. It is still. Yeah. The only place in the country that can tell you that. But here's concerns. Texas grid is not at capacity. We don't have enough capacity in the grid to service the needs coming forward. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, in my world, we don't have the water to meet the need long term. So if we will address the grid and address the water, as a practical matter, we've set in place an economic engine that sees no bounds.
How do you address the water? Are you getting it from other states, outside of state?
Or? Being the water chair, I've got a detailed granular plan coming out in January. There's really four options for new water supply, and that is desal or marine. So our coastlines are Galveston, Houston's, Corpus. Those people should be desal or marine. Israel's done it forever. Decades.
Wow.
80-90% of their water supply is from the Mediterranean every day. They're so good at it, they export 20% up to Jordan every day.
Wow.
So it's there. It's done. Mm-hmm. It's affordable. So marine desal. And then we have what's called brackish aquifers. So Texas has about 3.2 billion acre feet. An acre foot is 325,000 gallons of 1 foot water across an acre. 3.2 billion acre feet to develop. And that is basically seawater or less. So we're already desaling seawater. We know we can do it. You may have better quality than that, but it won't be any worse than that. So we've got to develop the brackish aquifer systems. Thirdly, we have produced water opportunities, which Tech is driving the initiative based on some legislation and funding I've got the last three sessions. In the produced water realm out in the oil and gas fields of Delaware Basin, anywhere from 10 to 14 million barrels of water a day pulls up out of that oil field.
Mm-hmm.
It's the nastiest of the nastiest, the toughest of the toughest, but technology exists today to convert that to usable water supply. So you got the three desal opportunities, marine, produced, and brackish. The last is acquisition from other places in this country that over time have said, we have excess water and we would love to sell it. So we're engaging in those conversations. So you get those four things together, the brackish aquifer system is 150 years of water supply. But it doesn't happen if you don't go develop it.
Right. Yeah.
So that's my target next session is to bring that to a head.
How long until that's a problem, the water supply?
It depends on the area.
Yeah.
I've got some areas of the state that are running out of water today as we speak. The wells are dry.
Wow.
I've got some Georgetown article in the paper about a month ago. 6 years.
Oh, wow.
6 years. Travis Lake is about 40-50%. Never been over 50% the last few years with all the growth down there. So depending on where you're at, you're going down. Our area of the state is going to be 26% less than what it has in the aquifer systems today in the next 30 years. Now, they anticipate, the state planning document for water anticipates a 30% reduction in per agriculture, not mandated, but just because economically they can't afford to use the water. That's not a plan that we have to have. That's willing to, hopefully someone will die basically to provide what others need, and that's not where we need to be as a state. I want a water plan that thrives, that matches Texas' opportunities. I don't want one that just survives during the drought.
Yeah.
And so we'll get it done.
Why, if it's been so successful overseas, have they not picked that up over here?
Because we've sucked the water out of our groundwater because it's low-hanging fruit and our surface waters. It's just cheaper. So it goes back to that pay it forward. You know, people are looking at, I don't want to pay $5 more a month for water on this deal when I can pull it out of the ground over there. Well, you're pulling it out of a finite supply that is depleting rapidly.
Yeah.
And you can only pull it out so much.
The longer you wait, the more expensive it's going to get.
It don't get any cheaper than it did today.
On that same subject, obviously, I follow a little bit of, growing up in Michigan and stuff like that, stuff with that, RFK is doing with the Detroit River and things like that. Have you ever worked with him? What do you think about?
I haven't worked with him.
Because he's done a lot with water himself.
Yeah. I think lead was up there. Was that Wisconsin or Michigan? It was Michigan.
Mercury,
right?
and lead.
So fortunately, knock on wood, Texas doesn't seem to have a lead pipe problem. The connections from the house to the alley is kind of where you get in trouble.
Yeah.
We've got some money out of the feds, some of this infrastructure money that's supposed to specifically target those areas. Typically, your more dilapidated areas, gentrified areas where those people have just been cut off and property values aren't there. So whatever the lead, it's in the ground, and I'm sure there's pockets that are pretty heavy, but we don't have a huge lead problem. Our surface waters are pretty clean. Pretty decent shape. So we don't have some of the problems that Michigan and some of those guys have done. As far as a national conversation, the Texas conversation I'm having. I've also had some conversations with the Bureau of Reclamation out of Laramie, Wyoming. They're the supply people for the country. It's time for an Eisenhower of water. It's time for a kind of a connected oversight of what each state's doing to meet its water needs and where can they be more efficient, maybe in a compact arrangement where they can develop more water differently from different sources that maybe a state doesn't have, but collectively that source could provide water for the entire western side.
Yeah, because it seems like everybody nationwide, I mean, each state's seems to have their own creative way that they're yeah. working this situation,
and it's okay
everywhere, you know. So it's like yeah. when does everybody kind of come together, compare notes, and
well, the question I asked for the Bureau guy was, if someone in Texas is pulling from a source that's north or south or east or west of the state, and somebody just to the west are designing plans to do the same source, does anybody know what the right hand and the left hand is doing? And the answer yeah. was no.
Because
so
I mean,
we need that, because there's going to be some really expectations not met and some hurt feelings over a source that's been used that nobody knew was being used at the time. So it does require some coordinated effort.
Yeah, because we have a big contract that we pull a lot of water even out of Carlsbad in New Mexico right now, don't we?
No, we are in battle with New Mexico. We actually. I have been in a lawsuit for my tenure as a legislature north where Canadian River, but there's a lake over there. And what New Mexico did is we had an agreement to pull, I think, 250,000 acre feet off of it once it hit a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
They could do the excess. Well, they went in and built up their dams higher. So what was once excess that we could take is now no longer, and it's been captured by Mexico. So we've been in a lawsuit for years. We spend millions of dollars every year to try to debate that issue. That water, I think, was coming into the Meredith system, I think, at one time or another. So,
wow.
So.
All right.
That's fun.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
yeah, because I was under the understanding that we were getting water out of there, that it was a contract
that we had had for a long time. Our oil and gas industry has got some arrangements with Eastern New Mexico, but what Eastern New Mexico or what the governor in Mexico did a few year, maybe two, maybe back, she cut off all pretty much exports of water to Texas in the oil and gas sector, partly because of the quote fossil fuel assault. And actually, Texas is selling their water over there, which is the right of the landowner to do that. But it's a shame that we're subsidizing their
their
industry. We just need a change out at November to get us back on energy independence, get us back on common sense stuff that makes sense, get us back in job creation, get us back, start working down the debt with some mm-hmm. hopefully courageous legislators that
yes.
can shut out the silliness and the desires instead of the needs.
Yeah.
There's some things we need to do now that we've allowed government to do. We're not going to pull them back. But there's a lot of things that we're letting them do or ask them to do that we got to quit asking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned November, so.
Yeah.
it was gonna be mentioned at some point.
Yeah. I was in a place the other day, and they asked the panelists, actually me, I was with four other senators and a couple of reps on some water stuff at an event, and who's going to win the November election? And all my colleagues were, Trump's going to roll, and it's going to be easy, and it's going to be good because it's an economic pocketbook issue. And historically, that is a correct statement. People in this country historically voted their pocketbooks. 2020, nobody could argue that Trump's pocketbook policies were working, and he did not get elected.
Mm-hmm.
So I said it this way. I said there are so many things between now and November that are unanswered. What does a felony conviction do?
Yeah.
Even if it's a small one, but it's a real right. felony. The courts didn't go, that's a little felony. It's right. a felony. So what does that look like, and how does that play out in November? Because technically you're off the ballot at that point, but you're on the ballot, right? So
yeah.
That's before convention. So I don't have that answer. Nobody does.
Yeah.
And so you got those elements, those fractions. But you also have to realize that this current administration is finding ways to buy votes every day. Now, he's spending money on an area of the voter base that historically does not vote, the kids. These write-offs of student loan debt. So he's doing everything to counter Trump's economic policies by growing government and spending money we don't have. So I think that if Trump survives the challenges and comes out where he's still eligible, I like his chances. But at the same time, all bets are off with the people that vote today. And until we as a country decide to take our country back through the civil process at the polls that were given to us, it ain't going to happen. The problem with that is there's nobody that desires to take it back. They like where it's going, you know. And there was a Christian writer, I get asked this a lot, make the border make sense to me. Why would anybody allow open borders to the detriment of a country? I mean, it's clearly, to Abbott's credit, getting those folks shipped around the country changed a narrative to a national narrative that was not there. Mm-hmm. But what is that? Well, first of all, if it's not logical, it's spiritual. And I think there is that element of destruction of the greatest country on earth that allows freedom of religion. There's a piece of that. But more importantly, I said that book is back in 1981. I think Schaefer wrote it, Christian Manifesto. In that book, he basically made the case that there would be a point in time where people would accept tyranny over anarchy because it's lesser of two evils. So what government historically has always done is created chaos, void of rule of law, let it get so bad, and I call it the misery index. The misery index creeps up to where people will look to anybody that can provide a solution, and big government, which will get bigger under that scenario because they thrive during chaos, mm-hmm. is going to come in and say, we're here to help now. Even though they were the ones that encouraged and created it, we're here to solve it. There's a medical term for Munchausen disease where you create the disease. I kind of make that, and that's very offensive to some people, and I apologize for that, but it's that, again, we allow it so we can better ourselves for it. And that's what this machine of the government that we currently have is doing. That's the only explanation I have is to grow government.
That's what killed me about that. I almost couldn't even watch it on the presidential address just recently, that he's like, I'm, you know, taking back the borders and we're closing down the borders and stuff. And I'm like, when did this happen? You know, when did we decide to go this route? And immediately that's what I kind of thought of is like, okay, we created chaos, now we're going to come in and look like the hero.
Yeah, but if you looked at his actual policy, it wasn't anything.
Yeah,
it's okay to allow 5,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to beef up the system so we can process them faster.
Yeah, yeah.
Without any thoughts of assimilation or naturalization, no process. And then in that conversation, it'll be we get them to the polls quicker. And truthfully, this is the way our country works, agree or disagree. As these people have kids, those kids are already citizens at that point. So
that
long-term play here, I don't know how long-term and long-term is, but, you know, looking down to the agenda and where it's heading, it's not going to – it's our constitutional republic will not survive.
Yeah, I believe
but
that.
But if it doesn't survive, whose fault was it?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's our own fault.
I agree. You got another one or you want me?
Go ahead.
I've got so there was I believe it was another podcast that I was listening to. They were running down the difference in economics between, they just happened to start comparing Texas and California. The surplus of income that we have and that we're green, you know, in the green in our accounting, and they're almost exactly that number in the negative in their account. And it just, you know, I got to thinking about that and stuff, and that we're one of the few states that is doing pretty good economically. And what, with that surplus that we're having, what are our plans with it? What is everybody's kind of vision with that, and where are we going to improve, and why, and this may be a very simple answer. It was just kind of something that I was thinking of, especially probably because of running a small business. Why aren't we running the state more like a bank and stimulating the economy with these small business loans and stuff like that, and helping these little guys out that are trying to start out on a program like that, where we have them nationally? Nationally, they seem to be so many hoops and everything else to jump through, they're almost not even worth it. So why wouldn't we do that with our on the state level for our own citizens?
Yeah, we do quite a bit of that, actually. It comes to the governor's office. It's typically economic development grants. Mm-hmm. There's a few loans mixed up in that. As far as small business administration statewide level, that's really not in that. We do incentives with workforce. We do different things. I got a community. I serve 41 counties. Had 51 for almost 10 years in the redistricting. But one of the counties has a company interested in coming to Texas. I think it was from Kentucky or one of those. But either way, they've applied for a $4 million economic grant to bring those guys in to be competitive with everybody else in the state. So we do a lot of that. I mean, every day you hear about another major Fortune 5 or something. So to your point, though, we have advocated for rural communities, small business opportunities. A 10 employer in a small rural community is like a 1,000 employer in Dallas. I mean, it's the same impact. Yeah. So those programs exist. It's just to your conversation with the federal, it's there a few hoops, and you're good stewards of taxpayers' dollars, right? So, but when we started these programs out, we didn't have a lot of guardrails and oversight over them, and we woke up and found out there'd been millions of dollars walked away with that nobody could account for where it went. So we do have those. We try to do those. We try to balance it with private sector so you're not creating an unlevel playing field. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're giving government subsidized loans or grants over here and a competing business in town, did you really help that? You kind of created a disadvantage or an incentive, if you will, for one and a disadvantage for the other. So it's all of those policy conversations that we look at.
Yeah.
So there's no easy answer there, but I do know communities have access, small businesses have some access to some of that stuff. It's just those that are warranted and merited based on the economics and the data.
Yeah. Okay.
So it does, but Governor Abbott replenishes that fund every year. You know, I can point to Samsung's, Toyota's. Samsung's need to do another plant. They need 40 million gallons a day of water. So we're trying to get our arms around what you do when you get all these industries coming in.
Yeah.
I forgot the math, but I think California had like a $20 billion surplus, and now they're $120 billion deficit, something like that.
Yeah.
It just flipped like that.
I think the numbers that I had heard was like $130 million deficit billion. Or something, or yeah, billion. And we're in $130 billion.
We were in $30 billion surplus last session.
Yes.
And so for the last three sessions, it's been a bigger budget than the previous one. Last session was the biggest budget ever in the state. I've seen it. I'm tired of one-offs and anecdotals once in a lifetime. I've seen the worst budget in the history of the state of Texas in 11. I've seen a pandemic, I saw Hurricane Harvey, and I saw an impeachment. I'm kind of done of those lifetime events. let's have a session that's just funding roads and bridges and schools and healthcare. Let's just get through one. Our economic success is no accident. To Governor Perry's credit, he laid the foundation of what a Texas should look like to be business friendly. And he implemented policies. To Governor Abbott's credit, he picked those up and enhanced and expanded. Texas, I think, was voted, again, the best state in the union to do business for the 20th year in a row last week, I think is what the record is. So we consistently and make policies with the initiative of bringing more jobs, decent, good jobs, for all Texans to have employment. And you throw that into... Every state has a tax. I don't care whether you call it property tax fees or whatever. There's taxes to be paid. Our property taxes is tough, but we don't have a personal or a corporate income tax. We have franchise tax, but last session, we just expanded that to where 67,000 businesses no longer pay franchise tax. Mm-hmm. We put $18 billion into property tax relief in the baseline budget now. So to your credit, where are we going to spend the next $15 or $20 billion surplus we're having next session? I hope we spend it on water. I hope we spend it in roads. I hope we shore up some things that we've kind of let slide behind. The last budget was inflated by COVID dollars and inflation. So you got to back that out to get to a kind of a true number.
Yeah.
We won't see another budget of $334 billion in my lifetime. And I kind of hope we don't.
Yeah.
We couldn't spend all the money constitutionally. So it's a good place to be. It doesn't happen with people not making very clear and deliberate and conscious decisions on policy and then being very aggressive. And we don't have to have the biggest economic incentive to draw people to Texas now. Just the sheer fact that we're Texas with the regulation environments that we have, they come. Because most states, especially on the blue side, you can't create a business. Business is bad.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a foreign concept to a big government. And
yeah.
And they find ways to frustrate and be the gatekeeper.
Yep.
I believe that.
We kind of dove into it a little bit, but talking about education stuff with the border crisis. But what are your thoughts on the current state of education and different measures to improve it?
Interesting. The voucher conversation comes up every year. It'll be up next year. I think there will be a voucher bill. My position is I'm kind of neutral. Here's the deal. Public education takes one and everybody. They don't get the option to tell someone no. So they show up on their doorstep. They show up in the classroom. My wife taught for 28 years. People need to go and sit in a public school classroom just for one day from anywhere in the state. But until we get a hold of the discipline issues in the public classroom, there is no reason we should do a voucher, because the kid that needs to be out of the classroom will not be the kid that moves with that voucher. So I look at public education reform very clearly. First of all, the pay has gotten decent. I think it's 55. Maybe better than that average starting. So we've done some things in the pay side, but it's the discipline factor that I think what my teachers tell me they're leaving the classroom for.
Yeah.
It's they can't teach, there's no respect, it's violent, it's ugly, it distracts from the other 99% of the kids in the classroom. So my bill last session I filed was a harsh discipline bill. It was old school, it's what we grew up. You didn't get to stay in the class if you're one of those kids.
Yeah.
We found a different learning environment for you. Yep. So we gotta go back. So on the public education reform, we've got to fix our discipline in the classroom first, because the argument for a voucher system is it breeds competition. It's not competitive if you make that teacher keep that kid when the other schools don't, because it's right. A whole different learning environment with that kid. So fix the discipline program. Secondly, the way the last voucher bills were pitched was they had 100% access from online virtual schools. That's not a good learning environment. There's more to public school environment than reading, writing, arithmetic. It's the social. It's conflict resolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all of life, right? So you get that element. When you provide a voucher to an online virtual school, unfortunately, there's a group of parents that are so disengaged that kid's never going to see the inside of a public school. So I want to limit on that. Accountability standards. Everybody knows about STAR test. I don't care about STAR. I don't care if you use the military aptitude. I don't care if you use the Iowa normed. I just want a standard that all are graded by. It's just fiscal to me. I don't want to ask finance in 2 years and say, how'd we do? And the response be, because we use STAR test and private school X uses this, SAT or whatever, that we don't know. We don't compare apples to oranges very well. So I think you've got to have a limit on virtual. I think you have to have an accountability standard that is the same accountability standard. I don't care. Pick it. Just pick one, but everybody uses it. And then I think the discipline issue has to be fixed. If you get those three things right, then public schools will legitimately be competing with private.
What about curriculum? Just the curriculum standard, too.
Core classes.
Common Core's not there. We keep a pretty tight look on curriculum. Obviously, our libraries have gotten exposed for some less than what most parents would consider outrageous and unnecessary and pretty belligerent. So we've got things in place to where we hopefully we catch that. Hopefully most of that stuff's been removed. The curriculum itself you know, it's a different math today. I thought 2 plus 2 was 4, but I've sat through a math class, and I can't tell you how 4 gets there anymore. But the kids are learning in that. It's what you teach. You know, the kids have learned that, and supposedly it's better because they can prove up why they got what they got. But I just knew I had 4 fingers. It's a different curriculum, right? But the teachers that are in classroom are bright. Very few teachers are not there because they don't have a love of kid. But when you short-circuit the ability to love on those kids by a disruptor, that kid's got to go. And our public school's under siege, and they're losing good teachers. And kids literally have no consequences and know it, no boundaries, and they test them in a very violent way a lot of times in this state.
Well, and, like, I guess me growing up in Michigan, we always had every one of our counties, our school counties, and I don't even know if that's a thing here. I guess I've never thought about it. Is there alternative education here?
Yep. So we have multiple places to put those kids that are in trouble.
Can teachers send them there?
Well, and so yes and no. The teacher can remove them from the class by sending them to the office or administration, but there's a process they go through.
Through
the administration.
Okay.
And it falls into two categories, the 504 kids, which are our special needs kids, and the non-504 kids. The 504 kids are federally regulated.
Yes.
And some of those are physically challenged, which you got to have a heart for in life science, and they do a good job of inclusion and getting those kids. And kids that are around them are probably better than the kid that was getting the lifestyles. And some of them are very nonverbal and stuff. So it's mm-hmm. that kid. And then you have what I call the troubled or the hard kid, the emotionally disturbed kid.
Yes.
And they may fit under the 504 realm, so we're kind of restricted on just how far we can go. But I'll put it this way. A 130-pound eight-year-old that is violent can do a lot of physical damage on a 110-pound teacher.
Absolutely.
And that 8-pound that's out of control, that 8-year-old, 130-pound that's out of control, cannot learn in that environment, nor should they be tried to make them because it robs them. So we got hard conversations because these are conversations that were had 30 years ago, and we used to do some of these hard things, and everybody was better for it because of advocacy groups that we don't punish and we don't discipline and we love and we don't, all this stuff. These kids are just kids, right? They're going to go as far as you allow them to. And they know where those walls are, and now they've got a parent group that supports it.
Yes.
Because a lot of those kids in those classrooms, it's a respite period for the parent because they lost control of the house.
Mm-hmm. True.
So, but it doesn't belong in our public school classroom. That's my initiative next year.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, our alternative education, especially when I was in high school, it grew.
Our charter schools. Our charter school is kind of in that realm. The non-traditional kid, you know, let's say you get pregnant at 16 and you don't want to be in the classroom, you've got a path out. It's a great system. The charters do a lot of things. We have competition in Lubbock. We have private. We have charter. We have homeschool. Homeschools grew, doubled since I've been in session. So it's a different homeschool environment. You know, your old homeschool is not the same homeschool. It's a coordinated network of curriculum and support groups. So we have competition. That said, I'm not opposed to some kid that's struggling in a classroom. And most superintendents, if they're honest, will tell you there are certain kids that we will never reach. And if they can find a better path, we're willing to let that happen. But this mm-hmm. carte blanche, wholesale, 5.5 million kids can bail anytime they want. And I would argue the other side, if I'm a private school, you're awfully naive if you believe that the state is telling you they will not change how you teach or why you teach or what you teach today, because it will be a court down the road that will change what you do. The state may not, and that's what we tell them. You can take this money, no strings attached, but it's public money. Someone will sue, and a court will force them to take kids that they're not taking, and you can ruin your experience. So mm-hmm. be careful what you ask for. You may get it. If you're the dog that catches the car, you may not have an answer for how you get rid of the car. It's a long-term conversation that you need to have and avoid the short-term glamour and glitz that comes with it.
Yeah. On the school subject, we just had this conversation a little bit ago. What was it, 2 episodes ago or something? What's your thoughts on extending public school, going into college, you know, we kind of had the conversation of, you know, we're setting 18-year-olds out there to try to figure out their lives and start picking college paths and stuff like that, that they're going to go down, that they probably don't have any interest in or going to lose interest in, halfway through it. And what about maybe making these kids spend another 3 years in school trying to figure out that stuff, more focused on career path stuff, more focused on the kids, you know, where you're going to go in life, college, whether it be trades, whatever the case may be.
So in Texas, we do a really good job, and I'm a huge advocate. And since about 13, we put in what's called, I think it's CORE, but there's 5 paths to get a diploma, 5 different CORE processes. So, and only probably 2 of them are college bound. The others focus on trades or certification, industry certifications. I don't know if you've had a chance to go out to Lubbock Cooper. That is the pinnacle of what our intentions were. They have a full-blown culinary school. They have a full-blown wood shop and mechanic shop, and they have a full-blown metal shop, and they have a full-blown fashion merchandising. They have, you know, the 3D printer environment for those aptitudes. So we specifically went down that road because not all kids are college material, nor should mm-hmm. they go there. And truth of the matter is, college needs to get more serious about legitimate degree programs that actually provide income
mm-hmm.
and stop doing the nonsense classes. So there's this healthy squeeze, I think, on the higher ed community that's really realizing the gig's up. You know, and Europe's kind of like, if you're not a doctor, lawyer, engineer, or professional, you have these trade opportunities. And our trades, up and down the line, the average age is aging out, and everybody still needs plumbers, mechanics, electricians. And so Texas needs those people for all of these industries coming in. So
yeah, absolutely.
TSTC is a kind of a quasi-community college. It's got 16, I think, locations around the state. Their facility in Abilene is second to nobody as far as up-to-date manufacturing equipment and kids learning and teaching and walking out of there with $50,000 to $75,000 a year jobs.
Yeah.
So we focused on that. The neat thing about that program is they don't get paid unless the student graduates and gets a job that pays well.
Oh, really?
So we have tried to squeeze that into the higher ed.
Oh, community. You can imagine that's pretty cool.
That is not happening very easy.
No, it's not.
That model has survived, and if you don't, you get a refund. The story is they've only given one refund in the history of their schools, and it's literally that good. And employers can go there with competence and recruit. We've also opened up the door for employers to mentor and bring kids in during the high school years to apprentice, if you will, so that
yeah,
when they graduate,
yeah, that's great.
They can do those journeyman-type licenses and stuff. If they want to be a master plumber, then obviously there's a whole other level of college and stuff. So
yeah,
I think we're there. We've got it going on. It is a resource issue because not all communities can afford that kind of infrastructure.
Yeah.
But it is a recognition of reality that we embrace and promote and try to encourage, and we try to make schools more accountable by the session, specifically higher ed. We want them to show us what they're doing and what they're producing. We still have those degrees that go nowhere, and the lifelong students that really need to move on in life, but they're not going to. They'll have to. So
yeah,
they get their debt paid.
Yep. Yeah. And they'll never leave. Why would you leave?
Yeah.
We got that at SPC right now with our class, like our summer classes. They're called practicum, mm-hmm. and my professor will help you get a job or go talk with your employer. Basically set a list for stuff that the student needs to accomplish that summer. And if you hold the job and accomplish that list, you in return get school credit.
Right. Makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And employers love it because they kind of know what they're getting.
Yeah.
And there's some reality check that getting a paycheck and kind of being ingrained in a culture. We intern account at wannabes all the time. Usually after about 4 or 5 weeks of tax season, you're going to know if you want to do this job or not.
Yeah. So, Yeah. I mean, and me having a college age kid going off to school next year here, you know, I mean, it's, we're having those really hard conversations right now. Like he's wanting to, I almost had him call you the other day. He's wanting to get into finance. And he's like, yeah, you know, I think this is going to be the path and everything else. And I've told him, you know, both the boys, you know, eventually there's going to be a day that I walk away from this place. And I said, it would probably help you guys if you have any interest in this business and this, you know, this line of work or anything else, probably have a business degree or some kind of business sense, some kind of business schooling, you know. So he is kind of taking that into account a little bit, but you know, we've had these conversations like, is this going to be something that you really see yourself making a career out of and stuff? And I think so. And it's like, well, you can't decide, you know, where you want to go for fast food right now. Right. So it's like, I think it's probably just as stressful on the parents as it is the kids.
You're not the best, yep. But you know, I'm 62 and I still don't know what to do when I grow up. But I do know this: I do not recommend a career change for $600 a month.
Yeah. So
you know, I just say if you're going to do something different, probably not this would be the. It's, I tell you what, it is rewarding and it is a blessing and it is a privilege. And you grow in so many different ways because you cannot imagine the multifaceted personalities of people. And you think you know people until you've actually had hearings that you really get to know people.
Yeah.
It is a big state with diversity of cultures and things that come through there with all their hearts and their testimony and their pleas and their ideas and their solutions and things. It's just a growth that nobody can experience, and it's really fortunate to get to do it. But it consumes you. If you're engaged in working at it, it is a consuming deal.
So. Yeah, yeah.
How often you get phone calls? You kind of mentioned you're busy because everybody's got your phone number, but like just some guy that's known you for a while and calling to complain about his pothole on his street or something.
You know, the potholes I don't hear much about. Those are local, and it's easy to direct those. You know, I get a regular. I had one this week from someone that was having a TCQ issue. My staff would say that all 30 million people have my cell number.
Sure.
That's an exaggeration.
Sure.
And what I try to do is redirect them to staff, because if I take that call and I tell you that I will do something, the odds of me remembering that I'm going to do what I said I was going to do by the end of the day after the other 20 calls that came through is not good. So I'll route them to the staff, and we'll get them in our system so that there's people working on the issues. So it doesn't happen quite as much as you'd think, but it does happen. And, you know, 90% of the time there's a reconciliation or resolution that really everybody likes and works. It's really rewarding. And there's that 10% out there that they're just jacked up, screwed up, and probably they're on a cord, self-imposed, that they deserve what's coming. So, you know, you just got to kind of be able to call it like you see it, and balls and strikes, and be as transparent and honest, and you know, say what needs to be said, and try to address it the best you can.
Yeah. Getting off politics. I mean, you sports fan, you.
You know, I'm a college sports fan. I don't pay much attention to the pros. I guess Mahomes has kind of brought me back into a little bit of the football.
Mm-hmm.
But we watch Tech baseball. We got season tickets to baseball and basketball. Go to the football games by virtue of there's always somebody coming into town from Austin needing to sit somewhere. So, and I love. I was with McGuire at lunch today. He spoke at a prayer breakfast, mm-hmm. and I'm impressed by that guy. I think he's got a great heart for those young men. And they need something like that. And we're good to have, I think all of our coaches, McCaslin and Tadlock, takes a vested interest in the well-being of those kids.
It really seems
And so
like,
it's really a good program. So I enjoy the college sports. I've got four littles that this is the first week we didn't have three T-ball games and two basketball games. So.
Yeah.
And when you're talking pre-K or kindergarten T-ball, it's painful sometimes. Yes. But it's fun stuff. It's good stuff. But so my kids were very athletic. They were very talented and very athletic, and we were on a field or in a gym probably from about 5 years old till they got out of high school. So we're restarting that that of our life and this fun stuff. So I put it this way. I'd rather be working in a wood shop, a garden, or reloading, or messing around in the house than to be sitting in front of most sports events. But but I'll do it. I mean, I have other priorities. I don't play golf. I don't have a attention span for 5 hours of much. And I had a pastor friend of mine that's passed now said, if you're going to lose your witness or your testimony doing it, you probably shouldn't do it. So I play one or two charity events a year because I do. And, and then they're not bad, but I'm not a big golfer. Not that I have anything against it. I just have other things I'd rather be doing.
Yeah, I agree. What about hunting?
I do hunt. I like to bird hunt a lot. I don't, I'm not near as angry at the deer as I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
A good morning of deer hunting is in the truck with the heater on and a radio and a little bit of breeze if you drop the windows down and the sun come up, and hopefully you don't scare them off just to watch them. But I will go hunt and fish and bird hunt. I like bird hunting more than anything if I do. But, you know, just getting out. It's just the experience being out. And the facility or the place and the people. So.
I'm a diehard deer hunter. I love my deer hunting.
Yeah, I used to be, and I guess I got to where, and I'll show you a picture or two here before we get out of here. But I don't mind it. We've been in this. Texas Parks and Wildlife is over my committee, and you get to know all the big ranch owners and places throughout Texas, and every once in a while they'll let you sneak in on something that's pretty nice and all low fence. You know, it's just managed well. They just take care of their animals as far as making sure food's available and stuff like that. So there's always a chance to do something that's kind of special. So
I'll take
Matthew. My son will go. Garrett's not a big hunter. He's a golfer and a soccer player.
I didn't know he was a soccer player.
Oh, that dude can play soccer, and his kids, really? I think, are going to take up soccer. They're going to be good. But Garrett can still move the ball with his foot better than I can throwing it.
Really?
Yeah, he's pretty good.
I knew he was a pretty good golfer. I'd heard that he's.
It's funny. My golf game frustrates people like Garrett because I might play every once every 5 years, and I'll just knock the crap out of the ball and be competitive. I'll come in at 95 or 100. You know, if I actually took it seriously, tried to play it, it'd be probably something I could be proud of, but I'd be broke.
That's cool. Got anything else?
I don't.
No?
Guys, I've enjoyed it. I appreciate it. Sorry it took a while to get me here, but truthfully, it
was well worth it.
It's a fluid schedule. I mean, you really never know what the next call. I've got three calls, one of them from a commissioner, land commissioner, so I don't know what's going on there. So, and you just hit someone. I'll tell you, Ken Hance, senator, representative, federal, chancellor, and there's just an energy that comes with this job, and it's hard to explain until you see it, but you just go, 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 go. I told somebody, I said, Ken Hance will still text me at 2 or 3 in the morning on something that he's working on. And I said, here's the sad truth. I'm usually up to answer it. So, I don't know what that says, but there's just, you know, Governor Perry, same way. I mean, you just stay in touch with those guys because we're not special. We're privileged to get to do it. But there's just a certain energy about it that's hard to explain until you get to do it.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
I've enjoyed having you, and like when we had Carl here, man, I mean, I just really saw it was more about the passion to serve, and you've got that same heart, and really appreciate getting to know you, and thank you for coming in.
Well, God's got a great sense of humor. Be careful what you pray. He might kick you through that door screaming every day, but it has been fun. It's worth it. Our country's worth it.
Yes.
My grandkids are worth it. Yeah. I have concerns, but at the end of the day, I know where it all ends, and we just got to do our part along the way.
And we definitely appreciate your work that you're doing.
Well, thank you guys again. It's been fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.